What a pleasure it is to have Cornel West with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, you wanted to take a trip with the eminent Dr. West.
Well, one of the things that's charming about your work, the pieces of it I'm familiar with, which does not include the academic, the hard stuff.
The hard stuff.
is the synthesis. And it is a synthesis from a rich perspective that is firmly grounded in academia, having done the research, but it's also firmly grounded in life experience, which means it not only stands the test of is it smart, but it also stands the test of is it relevant.
And I want to just add,
trivial.
It's also firmly grounded in your commitment to the deep spiritual realities.
Yeah, I say that though because you do a wonderful job of reaching back into certainly the history of the West.
You don't mean the Wild West.
No, I was thinking of someplace.
Western civilization.
Well, Athens and Jerusalem.
Well, and Africa.
And Africa, too. That's true.
Which is, you know, we tend to forget that. For starters, that's where we're all from. At least that's the current consensus. We tend to forget that. So the storytelling becomes even more important. But I'd like to walk through because the predicates are so important. You're talking about the history, the resource that we've gotten from the Greeks, the resource we've gotten from the Jews, and the resource we are beginning to get from Africa. So let's start with Socrates, one of my favorite troublemakers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, he means so much to me. He exemplifies for me at the highest level what it means to take intellectual integrity seriously and the ways in which it's inseparable from humility. The kind of learned ignorance that he talks about. He knows that he knows more than others because he knows that he knows nothing, and they think they know things that they do not know. I mean, that beginning point.
Isn't that
for
a beautiful
me,
place so to
start? So powerful, though, you know. It's there's something about this endless quest, this ceaseless quest for wisdom, for phronesis, meaning we never have possession of it, and therefore it's always a fallibilistic quest. We can always grow, mature, develop, and so forth. And Brother Bill was saying earlier, during the break even, about it's the great ones are those who know they have limitations and are forever trying to overcome them, and they recognize that it is a perennial quest. And Socrates embodies that. Now, of course, my attempt to kind of out-Socratize Socrates.
Which is everyone's job.
Which is everyone's job. But, of course, Socrates never sheds a tear. He never cries. There's a certain defect, I think, a Socratic level of wisdom in terms of his preoccupation with noble self-control and self-mastery that doesn't allow him to engage in the kind of heartfelt solidarity with the agony and anguish of oppressed people, the crying people, and afflicted people. And hence, the Jewish invention of the prophetic means so very much to me in terms of Hebrew scripture and how you start with the hated people, the despised people, and oppressed people crying out for help and then connect with a power that is, in fact, a source of empowerment as you are told to be human is to be kind to the stranger, the widow, the oppressed, the poor, and so on.
So then one has this deep need to question.
Absolutely.
And be and keep one's integrity, one's personal, individual integrity intact, added to which one must be looking to the other.
Absolutely.
And then,
I don't want to pass the justice piece of the
yes.
of the Jewish is just so central in the Jewish tradition and is so central in what is required for social people to get along. If there's going to be two or more of you are gathered together, if there's no justice,
there's no
we
justice.
Got a problem.
You got a problem. And that's true for nations, it's true for individuals, it's true for communities. Absolutely right.
So justice doesn't just sort of happen. It's an idea that emerges, that evolves, yes?
Absolutely. And an achievement that takes tremendous sacrifice, struggle, and service to others to attempt to stay afloat, because I think there is a sense, you know, the great Reinhold Niebuhr's definition of democracy is a proximate solution to insoluble problems. There's a sense where justice is like that, too. You got to keep that ideal in front of you to appeal to the better angels of your nature, because you're always going to fall short.
So that we have now two very powerful tools.
Absolutely.
And I say that rather than weapons. As we think about who we are now and how we are now and where we might be moving, and then you add kind of an engine, which is
But let me just ask one question. Now, you made a distinction between tool and weapon that is fascinating. Now, what was behind that, though? Because, see, I think of Ephesians 6, right? You got to put on the whole armor. The last chapter is about democratic armor. And I wonder whether I've fallen into militaristic metaphors that come out of a certain ambiguous legacy of Jerusalem. So that I do talk about weaponry in my own way. Well, you say tools. Now, I like that distinction. I wonder, I could learn from that in the ways in which that might have to back off from that kind of metaphor.
Well, our words matter.
Absolutely.
And it was really that from which I was pulling back a little bit to make sure that I wasn't falling into what is a very easy trap in the current world to militarize things. And you speak so eloquently about the challenges we have in a culture, in a nation, in a world where the will to the military solution is so strong and has infected us in many ways.
Mm.
Yes?
I can do this. The difference is the tools are creative, which gets us to Africa.
So the tools are creative and the weapons are destructive.
That is their intent.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just off the top of the head, but that does get us to, I think, my understanding of because you're really talking about a metaphysical tool, pardon me, for saying that in public.
We'll forgive you this one time.
I like it.
But it's a tangible metaphysical tool. You can dance to it.
That's exactly right.
Will you please say what it is, Dr. West?
No, indeed, because what I call the black invention of the blues, which is rooted in both the African experience in the New World, but also the creativity based on both Africanisms and wrestling with the modern world. And of course, with jazz, you've got European instruments in which the same tool is channeled through. In a very refined and sophisticated set of forms and genres and so on. So you really do have, you've got Athens, you've got Jerusalem, and then you've got Africa in the New World as these three fundamental tools. You all got me engaged in tool talk. Weaponry talk. I like this. I like this.
This isn't just political philosophy talk. This is so incredibly rooted in Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Every day, absolutely. Absolutely. Because one of the things I am fundamentally committed to is how do we keep track of the complexity and richness of everyday experience of concrete living and joy and dying and sorrow and so forth and so on. And this is why even existentialists like Kierkegaard and others have always meant so much to me. Because the concreticity of ideas, ideals, visions, and so forth. It's both not a play thing, even though you can be playful about it, because, of course, you had to have the Socratic spirit in terms of acknowledging the fallibilism. But on the other hand, what's at stake is life and death.
You talk about your characterization consistently of that African perspective is tragicomic.
Tragicomic hope. Yes, tragicomic hope.
Yes,
exactly. There you go.
Wait,
yeah, you always want to add that hope. You always want to bring that hope in. Absolutely.
Why?
Particularly now.
Well, because I think there's forms of the tragic comic. I think one of the greatest 20th century figures is Kafka. Kafka is so dark that you can't even see the darkness because it's not even a perspective available independent of the darkness. Now, is there hope in Kafka? We could write a dissertation on. But that's different than the blues. There is always some kind of light in the blues that even Kafka would be a little suspicious of. And I respect Kafka's darkness, but this is not Kafkaesque. He's part of the family of the tragicomic. Tragicomic hope situates you in a certain section within the tragicomic. Chekhov would be almost halfway house. He's not as dark as Kafka, but he's got less hope than the blues, but he's right in between, you see.
I think I need for you to say why something can be both tragic and comic at the same time, such that you can put them together into one word.
Yes, it's a very good question, too. I mean, by tragedy, we're talking about freedom. We're talking about human agency that hits against limits and constraints, or what the Greeks call anangē, those things that one cannot overcome. So you've got the great tragic protagonist. They exemplify almost quasi-divine qualities, but they still have limitations, sometimes their own lack of self-knowledge, their hubris, and so forth. Comedy is about the limitations. It begins with the limitations, be it the body, and its operations are being in the mind and the limitations of the mind. I mean, Chekhov, in some sense, is the highest form of comedy precisely because he recognizes if you're really going to be intelligent, then you acknowledge the limitations of critical intelligence and still attempt to be intelligent. So there's still a stress on limitations, but it's not so much about body. It's about what many consider to be the highest faculties, which is intelligence. Now, to bring tragic comedy together means that you both have the stress on the freedom and the limitation and the unbelievable tension that generates, and you still attempt to endure and persist and persevere. And it does tend to be darker because the comic tends to go places the tragic doesn't want to go. The comic goes into the steady ache of misery of everyday life. Tragedy tends to be more concerned with the extremity of cases. When you go to everyday life, and if it is as tragic in everyday life as so many of the tragic writers think can be characterized in an extreme case, then it's actually much more painful and more darker, you see. That's why Chekhov, I think, in some ways is even darker than Dostoevsky.
And when we come back, we will put hope into that equation. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are honored.
This is the Cornel West Show.
And today, Paula and Bill get to join Cornel West, Dr. Cornel West. We trust that you will join the three of us when we return in a moment.